Welcome to the third meeting of our short seminar. And today we're going to talk about Egypt and the Hebrew Bible. And I should prepare you for some maybe frustration. Because as an Egyptologist, my point of view is a bit different than the point of view that would be more straightforward and would find a lot of Egypt in the Hebrew Bible. And so we'll see how you feel about that at the end. Before we begin, I must take you on a little journey into Egypt of the first millennium BCE, okay? So this is the first point of frustration. Normally, when people talk about the connection between Egypt and the Bible, this interface between these two disciplines, they are drawn naturally to the time of the New Kingdom in the second millennium BCE, the Great Egyptian Empire that we talked about in the first lesson. And this is for various reasons. The first is that there is a disproportionate richness of textual finds and material culture in Egypt of that period. And it is far better known and far better researched. At least this was the case until the end of the 1990s. Because Egyptology itself was more concerned with the Middle Kingdom at the beginning of the second millennium and the New Kingdom in the second half of the second millennium. And it was less concerned with publications on the third intermediate period, which is the first millennium. So this created an imbalance, if you like, about how people from other disciplines, not Egyptologists, how the kind of information that they could receive from Egyptology was really more in favor of the second millennium BCE. However, I think, at least in this classroom, we can all agree that the biblical text is far more a creature of the first millennium BCE than it is of the second millennium BCE. And so we have to look more closely at this time in ancient Egypt. And in the past 20 or 30 years, this has become more readily available, and we have a lot more information about this period. It's called an intermediate period because, unlike the times that we call a kingdom, like the Middle Kingdom or the New Kingdom, Egypt, in most of this era, is not ruled by a single pharaoh who dominates the entire territory of Upper and Lower Egypt, but it is fragmented among different power centers. So the new empire, the New Kingdom Empire in the Levant, comes to its end around 1130 BCE, and we saw this in the first lesson. This is a date that was settled because of a base of a bronze statue that was found in Megiddo of Ramses VI, and it's considered the latest royal Egyptian New Kingdom find in the empire. So that's the point, 1130 BCE. It's true that it seemed that Egypt lost its occupations in the Levant or outside of Egypt at that time, but in Egypt, the Ramesside 20th dynasty continued for another almost 100 years with the late Ramesside, so from Ramses VI to the 11th. And the defining moments of this new kingdom were only reached at the end of the 11th century, so around 1070 BCE. And there was a civil war, there was a breakup of the local administration, of the local bureaucracy. And as a result, in the next period, after the death of the last Ramesside king, we find two new powers centers of power. One in Upper Egypt, in Thebes, controlled by the high priests of Amun. So these dynasties of priests, the high priest of Amun, during the last phases of the new kingdom, amassed a great deal of power and authority, as well as wealth, economic wealth, and the control of sources in Upper Egypt. And so when the last Ramessides could no longer exert their control over Upper Egypt, over the Thebes, they started, the priests of Amun and Thebes, started to consider themselves as kings. So you will find in Thebes a high priest of Amun during this period. Okay, we're talking about this here. Okay, the 21st dynasty. You will find high priests of Amun that call themselves kings. Kings of Egypt, they write their names in a cartouche, the oval frame that is reserved just for the name of the pharaoh. And they use the kind of privileges that are only for kings. So that's in Upper Egypt. In Lower Egypt, the local rulers of Tanis create a new dynasty. This is the 21st dynasty, as we speak of it. And they control the delta area as far south, maybe to Memphis, the exact line that divides between the sphere of control of the high priests of Amun in Thebes and the rulers of Tanis is not completely known to us. And this is the 21st dynasty until around 962. Then, for a short period of time, the 22nd dynasty, founded by a very famous Egyptian king, Shishak, Sheshonk in Egypt, for a short while reunites the kingdom under one pharaoh. So Sheshonk manages to not only be king in Tanis, but also become king in Thebes. And once he does that, he retains his control over Thebes by appointing his son as the high priest of Amun. And this is something that his successors will continue to do in order to control Thebes and control the entire country. But then, soon after Shishak the First, we have again a fragmentation period. So this is the 22nd, later part of the 22nd dynasty, 23rd, 24th dynasty. These are dynasties who are ruling at the same time. So they are parallel dynasties in different parts of the country, in the Delta, in Middle Egypt, and in Upper Egypt. Then again, for a short time, we have a reunification of Egypt under the Nubian dynasty. So this process of local rulers who are amassing powers also happens in to the south of Egypt, to the south of Thebes, in Nubia, in Kush, ancient Kush. And it's some and these dynasties are heavily influenced by Egyptian traditions. And at some point, one of these Nubian princes decides that Nubia is not enough. And he wants also Thebes, he gets an army, he starts heading north, and he doesn't stop until he conquers the entire of Egypt. And then we have this dynasty, the 25th dynasty, under whose rule we have a reunification of Egypt. So if you see, we have this cycle in the third intermediate period of a few decades of a unified country and then a few decades, sometimes century, of a fragmented country. So, why I'm telling you this? Because when you read in the Bible that Pharaoh, king of Egypt, did so and so, and the year is, let's say, 800 BCE, so which pharaoh are we talking about? because there's a pharaoh of the 22nd dynasty who calls himself pharaoh and uses all the attributes of a king, of a pharaoh. There's a pharaoh of the 23rd dynasty at the same time in a different town, and there's a pharaoh of the 24th dynasty at the same time in a different part of the country who calls himself king. So it's a bit difficult to do these synchronizations, which I think sometimes we think they're easy because, of course, there's a pharaoh in Egypt, but there are multiple pharaohs in Egypt in this time frame. So this was about Egypt in the first intermediate period. And because of all these problems, I have to, you know, give a warning, a fair warning. From the end of the New Kingdom, which is 1070 BCE, and until the Assyrian invasion in 664 BCE, there are no chronological anchors in the chronology of ancient Egypt. It is fluid. We know when it starts, 1070. We know when it ends, 664. But the entire third intermediate period is fluid, which means that if you open the handbook for Egyptian chronology written by Egyptologists, you will find more than one option for the years and the reigns and even the length of reigns of individual kings. The problem is, of course, that when we find an inscription from 800 BCE that says, fifth year of the king, we are again in this problem. We don't know which king is referred to unless we have the entire inscription. And as it happens many times, we don't have the entire inscription. We have a part of the inscription. And when we have local dynasts that are ruling in parallel, and we can't know always the situation. There is another problem. There is an imbalance in the records. When Egypt is controlled by one pharaoh, this is usually in the ancient capital of Egypt, which is Memphis, and the religious capital of Egypt in this period, which is Thebes. So we find all the records in Thebes, no problem. But then, if you have a king in the Delta, he will not leave his records in Thebes. The big difference between Thebes and the Delta is the state of preservation. The Delta is muddy, is wet, and we have very few records and a lot less records that survive in comparison to the records from Thebes. So, for example, in the early 21st dynasty, we have an imbalance. We know a lot about the high priests of Amun in Thebes, and we know much less about the kings of the 21st dynasty in Tanis. And, well, it's not because they were less important, as we can see from the necropolis in a moment, it's because we have a problem of preservation of records. So if someone is saying, you know, the 21st dynasty in Thebes was a very weak dynasty and they didn't have a lot of activities and a lot of monumental structures and a lot of projects, well, not necessarily. It's just that we don't have the same preservation, okay? I am using the chronology of Thomas Schneider, in his contribution from 2010 in Egypt and the Levant. There are other options as well, which you can find there. But we need some kind of framework to work with. So just a little bit more about the 21st dynasty. As I said, in Upper Egypt, the dynasty is centered in Thebes. It's a dynasty of high priests of Amun in the temple of Karnak, and they represent themselves as doing everything that an Egyptian king does. So if you go to Karnak and you see the reliefs of Cherichor in the temple of Khonsu in Karnak, you will see the representations of an Egyptian pharaoh with all that it means. So it's the Egyptian pharaoh who gives tribute, who gives offerings to the gods. So this is Cherichor doing this in these representations. He will have all the regalia, so the pharaoh's special crown, and so on and so forth. And the years will be counted according to his reign. Okay, so the fifth year of his reign, if you are in Thebes, it's probably the fifth year of Jericho and not the fifth year of a king in Tanis. At the same time in Tanis, these kings are doing exactly the same, including building a new Amun temple instead of the one that they don't have in Thebes. So the Amun cult is just as strong in the Tanite region as it is in Thebes. And again, we have considerably less sources, but we do have the royal necropolis in Tanis. And this is one of the most impressive necropolis that we have. It was a very famous book and exhibition, Tanis, Lord of Pharaon. And all you have to do is just go to the Louvre. This, I just took this beautiful little picture a few days ago in the Louvre. They had the richness and the resources and the way to get the resources and the know-how and the workshops of any royal dynasty in Egypt. It's a mistake to look at this 21st dynasty and say, yes, it's after the empire and they were totally different in their appearance. They were not. They were doing exactly like their forefathers were doing, and they definitely had the resources to do this. Moving on to the 22nd dynasty, just in this brief overview, of course, the main kings in the first part of the dynasty are Sheshonq I and his successors, Osorkon I and Osorkon II. And their time, only in their time, so from Sheshonq I to Osorkon II, the 22nd dynasty rules the whole of Egypt, the entire area, from its capital in Tanis. So Tanis becomes very important, but as I said, the sons of these kings become the high priests of Amun in Thebes, thereby exerting control over the entire land. In the second part of the 22nd dynasty, this fragmentation reaches its peak. And at some point, at the end of the 8th century, we have as many as 8 different kingdoms in Egypt. Each of them has a king or a local monarch that describes himself as a pharaoh. In Tanis, in Thebes, in Sais, in other places of the Delta, in Middle Egypt, and as I mentioned, also in Nubia. And this entire system comes to its end at 722, when this prince from Nubia, Pianchi, conquers Egypt in a blaze. And his successors become the Kushite kings of Egypt, and Egypt is reunited, and they reset the capital in Memphis. So they are going back to ancient times before the 21st dynasty. This is a big part of this looking at the past of the 25th dynasty, which is also going to be in the 26th dynasty. And this concludes the third intermediate period, the Kushite dynasty. It will conclude in 664 with the invasion of the Assyrians into Egypt, and that will start what we call the late period, and we will talk a little bit also about the late period. Okay, so of course now we can go back a little bit to Egypt in the Bible, now that we know a little bit about the first millennium, the milieu, the Egyptian milieu of the biblical text. There are many, many references to Egypt in the Bible, of course. We discussed this a few times, more than 600, and we won't go over all of them today. I hope you agree. So I just picked a few case studies to give you the state of research and how it is viewed, okay? In the Pentateuch, we have a few important mentions The one in Genesis 10 is actually the first time that Egypt is acknowledged, if we go by the order of the books in the Bible, which is obviously not in, necessarily the order of the historical part. And here we talk about Egypt being the son of Ham and in the Table of Nations. Then, shortly after, we come to the story of Abram and Sarai as they descend to Egypt. And this story, in a very contradictive way to the Exodus, is a kind of a good story. I mean, you know, they are in Egypt, it's okay. No one says that it's not allowed to go to Egypt. And if they suffer, they suffer because, if you remember the story, yeah, Abram says that Sarai was his sister and not his wife. So this was his problem. And the minute that this becomes evident to the Pharaoh lets them go. So this is a very positive perspective on the Egyptian king. And this maybe positive a thought about Egypt is also in the Table of Nations, okay? We don't have here a kind of blackening of Egypt as we see in later prophets. Then we have another very positive story about Egypt, the Joseph story, which is a thing of its own. We'll discuss it a little bit at length. And then, of course, we have the big contradiction, the story of the Exodus, which completely changes the perspective on Egypt, and Egypt becomes this really terrible, terrible, terrible monster in the Hebrew text. The other group that I would like to start discussing today is from the Solomon stories, from just the beginning of the United Monarchy. And this is a theme that we will continue also into the next lesson, because we will talk about Sheshonq. So we have a few stories here in this story of Solomon, okay? He's marrying the daughter of the Pharaoh, very exotic. We hear that the Pharaoh captured the city of Gezer and gave it to his daughter, the wife of Solomon. We hear that Egypt is also a place of refuge. So it's not only an ally of Solomon, it also takes his enemies. So it's kind of neutral, perhaps. Hadad the Edomite runs away from David to Egypt, as does Jeroboam the First. So let's talk a little bit about the Pentateuch. We'll start with the Table of the Nations. So the Table of Nations is very interesting because it talks about the, you know, the children of Ham, Shem, and Yefet. And as they talk about the children of Ham, from the beginning, there is this Cush, Egypt, Put, which is Libya, and Canaan, okay? And as you continue, I mean, for me, as an Egyptologist of the first millennium BCE, this is very natural, okay? Because we just talked about it, right? Maybe I neglected to say that the 22nd dynasty is a Libyan dynasty, but I assumed that everyone in the room knows, but I will say it now. Sheshonq and all his successors is a Libyan dynasty. And then we have the Nubian dynasty from Cush. So for me to see this together, yeah, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, is very natural. And the way I see this area of Canaan as under the sphere of Egyptian influence, as I elaborated in our previous meeting, it's also natural for me to see that Canaan is part of this sphere. And then it continues again in a very interesting phase to tell us that the sons of Cush are so-and-so. And among these so-and-sos, all these, you know, strange names that, again, are very much Cushite names, we have one Sabetka or Shabatka. And of course, this is the name of a known Kushite dynast of the Kushite period. And the other thing in this whole paragraph that I would like to note is that at some point, blah, 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 we are told, what is Canaan? Yeah? Le limite de Canaané. So it's from Sidon to Grar and Gaza and to Sodom and Gomorrah, Adma and Sabaim, which is again in the Sodom and Gomorrah region, Juska, Lesha, which may be also in the Dead Sea area. It is important to note that the Canaan that is described here from Sidon to Gaza is not the Canaan of the Late Bronze Age. It's not the Canaan of the Egyptian Empire, which was far larger than that and included many more territories. So this is a more nuanced and more recent view of Canaan as it was before the Israelites and the Judite nations. Now that we know that we have a Kushite period, okay, we can also read a little bit in the Syrian annals that there are in this time, in the end of the 8th century and the beginning of the 7th century, there are all kinds of confrontations between the Assyrians who are trying to expand into the southern Levant and the Kushites who are ruling Egypt and are trying to prevent this expansion. And the only way to prevent this expansion is really to get into Canaan, yeah? To get into the southern Levant. And so we have evidence of these conflicts that are occurring in the southern Levant. In addition, if we go back to archaeology, we see that in these final layers in Judah, those that were destroyed by Sennacherib in 701, we find Egyptian pottery. So we have great big storage jars of Egyptian origin that tell us a story, as well as Egyptian amulets also coming from Egypt. As I showed before in our previous lesson, at this time in Judah, we also find these Egyptian inspirations, okay, on the seals. We have the winged sun disk, we have the winged scarab, we have the four-winged scarab, we have, if you remember, the hieroglyphs on the Egyptian seals, the hieroglyph of the Ankh and other words in Egyptian that are meaningful. And of course, just to top it off, if we have the mention of Shabaka and Shabatku in this table of nations, it's interesting to know that Shabaka is the only dynast of the Nubian dynasty that we find his name in Megiddo, for example, on jars, or stamped on big jars. So, if we have to think about this table of nations and about the picture that it represents, which for me is also the picture of this descent of Abram and Sarai to Egypt, that is a very peaceful kind of descent where you go to the center, okay? And Egypt was the center of this region in this time, definitely in the Kushite period. And it is possible that although we know that the Table of Nations has priestly, so late layers, it could very well have some earlier memories in it. And we know there is an earlier layer in this passage. So for me, this earlier layer is really at the end of the Iron Age, the 8th century and the beginning of the 7th. From here, we can go on to the story of Joseph. The story of Joseph is probably one of the most researched points in Egyptology and in the interface between Egypt and the Bible. And already from really the very, very beginning of scholarship, a very important Egyptologist worked on the different details and ideas that are Egyptian inside the Joseph story. It was really immediately recognized. And like I said, in the very early publications, there was this bias towards Egypt in the New Kingdom and Egypt in the Middle Kingdom, these wonderful kingdoms that, of course, we have all this information, so we see how someone can go to court and become an important person. We have parallels from the New Kingdom and so on. But as I said, as we continued in time and we realized that the text is more a creature of the first millennium, we have to kind of put that idea aside. So the greatest advocate for the New Kingdom origin of the story was Virgot, who in 1952 wrote the first really exhaustive publication on the story of Joseph, and for the first time really collected all those Egyptian elements that are in the story. And he concluded, and again, this is the bias of the record that was in front of him, he concluded that all these things are best represented in Egypt of the New Kingdom era, so he would place the story in the second millennium BCE. It wasn't until 1970 that a very important Egyptologist and a very important, leader of the Egypt and Levant interface in our discipline, Donald Redford, wrote a study of the biblical story of Joseph. And he had quite different conclusions than Virgot. So when he looked at all the Egyptian, so-called Egyptian elements in the story, he realized that some of them were not really Egyptian. Okay, some of them are known from the ancient Near East. Okay, if we want to say, for example, the trade spices. Thank you, Eitan. The trade in spices is not only an Egyptian thing. It happens in the ancient Near East. We don't have to look at it as an Egyptian thing. And he also noticed that the things that you can pinpoint, which is the names that appear in the story, and the titles that are Egyptian, are really more relevant to the 7th century BCE, to the site period. And he placed the story in that date. So let's look a little bit at those details that he picked from the Joseph story. So like we said, the spice trade, which he could find evidence in Egypt from the 7th century before BCE. But he said, it's also something that happens not in Egypt. It doesn't necessarily have to be an Egyptian point. And if you look at things like slaves in Egypt, this is something that happened all along Egypt's history. We have evidence of Asiatic slaves in Egypt, in the Middle Kingdom, in the New Kingdom, and in the Third Intermediate Period, and in the Site Period. So it doesn't necessarily tell you of a certain time and place. Okay, the Khartoumim, right? These magicians of ancient Egypt, this word is an Egyptian word, and it appears in the biblical text. And that, again, is a word that we know from all periods in ancient Egypt. Some of the things he found were quite late, right? So, for example, this idea of cows representing years was something that he could find parallels to only in later Ptolemaic period. So we are already going quite down the line with the ability to date this story. Again, the same with the birthday of the king. He could not find evidence that was earlier than the Hellenistic period. And of course, this is also something that exists in other cultures. The 7 years of hunger as a motif in Egyptian texts, it appears in the Ptolemaic period, although since Redford's publication. We now know from a publication by Bernd Schipper that it already existed in Egypt a few centuries earlier, and we will get to that in a minute. Yeah, so the, for example, of something that was really made of a very important ceremony in the Joseph story, the investiture of Joseph, so this ceremony of how he becomes an important man in Egypt, part of the bureaucracy, the great administrator. This is something that we see in Egypt already from the 7th to the 2nd century and so on. The names that he talked about, so Potiphar, which is based on Paddy Para, a name constructed with the name of the god Ra. So this construction is very typical of names of the site period in Egypt. So this is the 26th dynasty, it's already after 664. Osnat comes from Nesnet, Nut, the goddess of the sky, who was the protector goddess of Sais, the site period again. And so we can go and see a few things here. The last thing I want to talk about is this part about the agrarian reforms. If you recall in the Joseph story, the Israelites get an exemption from taxation on the land of Goshen. So this is a wonderful advantage that they are getting through Joseph and his good connections with the Pharaoh. And this is part of a larger passage in the book that talks about the fact that Egyptians had to be taxed on their lands and who was exempt and who was not. And these kind of changes in the taxation of the fields was only put into place in Egypt, as far as textual records are concerned, in the 8th century. So, you see there's all kinds of things there, right? I mean, we saw some things that were already from the New Kingdom, and then some things who were already in the Ptolemaic period, and it's really much more complex than how the Egyptian details were presented before Redford's publication. And for Redford himself, the point of departure was the names of Potiphar and Osnat, which are really typical for the site period. We'll have a look at the site period. So Sais is a city in the West Delta, and with the Assyrian invasion of 664 BCE, the king of Sais, or the ruler of Sais, became the pharaoh of Egypt. So he cut a good deal with the Assyrians. And that was the opening point for the 26th dynasty. Oh, I see that Amon has moved for some reason. So this is a great king, Psamtik I, is a contemporary of these kings here. And Psamtik I is really very much involved in the Levant because of his pact with Assyria. And I'm always intrigued, and maybe someday we'll find the answer, for the name of the son of Menashe, Amon, okay, like the Egyptian god Amon. So big question there. Maybe someday we'll find the answer to that. But definitely the text, the biblical text, tells us that in this time frame, we have massive Egyptian intervention in whatever is happening in Judah. Okay, so Josiah is killed by Necho, which is the successor of Psamtik I. And Joachaz is demoted by the same king, and a new king, a king of Necho II, is put on the throne. You see that this change happens when Necho comes to the throne. So we have a reorganization of Judah in this time. So definitely a lot of Egypt in Judah in this time. The only problem is when we consider Redford's pinpointing of the site period, is the Joseph story seems to be a northern story. So it has a lot, I mean, the protagonist is, of course, not a Judahite, he's an Israelite. And this is one of the big problems with this interpretation. And of course, there are several theories on how to solve it, but they are still theories. The site period, if I just give you a little bit more insight into how it is happening in the Levant, in the 7th century, is a very strong intervention. We find the seals of Psamtich all over the country, mainly in coastal sites. We find in Ashdod things like this. This is not from Ashdod. This is a really beautiful Egyptian New Year bottle. But in Ashdod, we have quite a few of these. And these are really Egyptian things that you bring for the New Year. And this is the Shana Tova. Okay, present that you bring. And we find quite a few of those in Ashdod in this layer of the 7th century. Scarabs and amulets, of course. We have cultic, Egyptian cultic practices in Ashkelon and in Ekron. And we have an Egyptian fortress in Mitzad Chashavya, just south of Yavne, where not only Egyptian finds are there, but also Greek finds. And it is this Egyptian fortress, manned by mercenaries from the Greek world, that is handling the taxation in the southern Levant at this time on behalf of the Egyptian king. So there is, and this is a very important article by Bernd Schippe, who puts together all these finds and gives us for the first time a real indication that the 7th century in the southern Levant was very much in the hands of Egypt, albeit for a short time, yeah, just when the Assyrian withdrew. This is from Ashkelon, a find of Egyptian situlae. The situlae were used for ritual libations of water or of milk made of bronze, always decorated in relief. All these are decorated with reliefs of Egyptian deities, exactly like we have in Egypt. And this comes with an assemblage of statuettes and figurines of Egyptian deities, also from Ashkelon. So very strong influence right there. And then in recent years, there is another theory about the Joseph story. The Joseph story is a diaspora novella. The idea of a diaspora novella was initially introduced with regard to the books of Daniel and Esther, whereby there is this narrative of a Jew that comes to a strange country, is disadvantaged, but manages in the court to rise to greatness. And I agree that Joseph's story has these kind of elements in it. And we have quite a few publications, from the first one in 1975 to introduce this idea by Meinhold, and all the way to our 2021 Synergia Project publication, which gathers the latest articles on the Joseph story between Egypt and Israel. And I, this is really the furthest that I think we got in this idea of a diaspora novella. I see that there are some differences between Esther and Daniel and the story of Joseph. I definitely think that Daniel and Esther knew a lot more about the court than Joseph did. In Daniel, we have the name of the king, of course, in Joseph, it is only the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. We have in Daniel and Esther the name of functionaries, as we do here, Potiphar, the great priest of On, Heliopolis, the sun god Re, temple. And we have another Potiphar, which is Saris of Pharaoh. But we don't have in Joseph is a localization beyond Egypt, which in Daniel and Esther, we know we are in a specific place. And this very general kind of Egypt in Joseph is troublesome when we think about the diaspora novella, because which is this diaspora? Where is it? Egypt is a huge, huge country. And if we have, so we have no choice but to look for diaspora in Egypt if we want to present such an idea of a diaspora novella. And the first thing that comes to mind is, of course, Jeremiah admonishing the refugees from Judah who go to live in Egypt, in Migdol, Tachpenes, Nof, which is Memphis, and Patros, which is a general name for Upper Egypt, the southern country. And in a very interesting article by Aaron Meir, Meyer from 2002. He did the opposite of what we all do. We always look for Egyptian pottery in the Levant. He went to look for Levantine pottery in Egypt. And what do you know? He found it. Because in Egypt, in the especially in the excavations of the 19th century and early 20th century, pottery was treated in a kind of cursory manner. So, you know, you have these beautiful inscriptions and beautiful artifacts, and there's so much to do with all these finds. So at the end, the pottery is listed in these big plates of pottery, and, you know, sometime maybe we will talk about them. And so Aaron Meyer went back to these excavation reports and really could pinpoint and tell where is Palestinian pottery. And it wasn't only Palestinian pottery, it was specifically at some places Judean pottery. So in Israel and Judah, they don't have the exact same assemblages in the 8th and 7th century. There's a regionality. And so in a few places, you could also find this juglet, for example, which is a Judean juglet, locally produced. So it's not imported from Judea. It is made in Egypt according to a Judean typology. So I bring you back to the first lesson when we talked about the empire of Egypt in the Levant in the second millennium BCE. And we asked the question, how do we know that there were Egyptians in Canaan? And one of the answers was, there is locally made Egyptian pottery that is not this special Egyptian pottery, but just kitchenware, okay? Something that you use for everyday use, and you want it to be the same as what you have at home. So this could be the first traces of this diaspora in the 7th century. And Mumford in 2013, excavating in Tel Tabila in the Delta, also found this pottery. So it's interesting always in archaeology, once someone pinpoints to the fact that you have Judean pottery in Egypt, then all the excavators start to find it in their excavations because they know what they're looking for, okay? So it's very important. And but in fact, the most prominent evidence for a Jewish diaspora in Egypt comes a little bit later from the island of Elefantine. Oh my God, I'm running out of time. So in Elefantine, we have the archives of the Jewish community, colony of Jewish mercenaries, And they are together with Greeks and Arameans and Egyptians and Syrians and all these kind of different ethnicities. And this community really has some things in common with what we see in Joseph, in the sense that they are inclusive towards other religions. Okay, they're not like Joseph, of course, is marrying a non-Jewish wife, and they are immersed in the Egyptian culture, just as Joseph and his sons are. But at the same time, they worship Yahweh in their temple, and they have their problems with the priests of Chnum, also in Elephantine, and this is described in the archive. And this trouble at the end causes the temple of Yahweh to be destroyed by a royal decree. And this could be some point of tension, of stress, that could be the motivator for a diaspora novella of how you can actually succeed in Egypt even though you have these problems. So at the end, yeah, you notice that we had the very beginning of the Hebrew Bible, the first sections, yeah, in Genesis, and we arrived already to the 4th century BCE. So the earliest in the book and the latest almost in the first millennium. And we'll just take a moment to look at this other story of Solomon and his Pharaoh. So we are in the book of Kings. Yeah? We read this before. And here we are doing, one kind of biblical Egyptology. Solomon, according to the biblical historiography, is about 1000 BCE. Okay, we go to Egypt. What do we see in 1000 BCE? 21st dynasty. We have a king called Siamun. And in 1978, we have this article, Solomon and Siamun, a synchronism between early dynastic Israel and the 21st dynasty of Egypt. This has been a very influential article, and I would like to criticize it a little bit. So in Tanis, there is a relief of Siamun, the king Siamun here. Of course, it's fragmentary. Everything in Tanis is fragmentary. And he is in the position of smiting enemies. Okay, you see there's this hand is raised in the air. This hand is holding on to the hair of a captive. And he's about to smite him. And this captive carries this kind of weapon. It is a double axe. And now we have to say something important. We don't have the relief anymore. We only have the drawing. So we cannot check today what exactly is happening here. It's lost. But this was perceived to be an Aegean-sourced axe and therefore a Philistine enemy. Never mind that the Philistines just, you know, 100 years earlier, in Egyptian conventions, never had in the Ramesside, Ramses III, Medinat Habu reliefs, never had such a weapon, but okay. And so it was decreed that this is Philistine, and that here we have the king Siamun batting a Philistine, and a Philistine is in Gezer, because at the same time in Gezer there were found some Philistine bichrome sherds. And on the basis of this, it was decided that Siamun is the unnamed pharaoh who captured Gezer, the unnamed pharaoh who gave his daughter to Solomon. Of course, this overlooks a major element, motif in Egyptian royal iconography that starts already from pre-dynastic eras to the New Kingdom and to the late period of the king smiting his enemies. The king smiting his enemies is the king's duty to protect Egypt, like it is his duty to give offerings to the gods. So all the temples in Egypt are always decorated in relief of the king smiting his enemies. We have late Ramesside kings who everyone agrees have never left Egypt and probably not even their hometown, and they are portrayed when they are smiting Asiatic enemies, Nubians, Libyans, and whatnot. This is, of course, a symbolic relief, and we cannot deduce from that a campaign. But I want to say that this is more of a methodology that is the problem here. Because this methodology is, we take the Egyptian detail, in the Bible, a pharaoh in Gezer, okay. And we go according to biblical, inter-biblical historiography. We take the date, 1000 BCE, based on what, I don't know, but okay. And we take it to Egypt. And we look, what do we have there at 1000 BCE? We have the relief of Siamun. And now we interpret the relief of Siamun by the biblical text that says that this is Gezer and this is a Philistine and so on and so forth. And, well, that's biblical Egyptology, not at its best, I would say. Instead, I would urge everyone to do a different kind of process, okay? So, for example, if you take this detail of the Egyptian pharaoh in Gezer, so before you input this information into Egypt, you have to ask yourself and define what is this Egyptian intervention, okay, in general terms. So it is a military intervention in the region of the Shephela, okay, this is the Gezer, in the region of the Shephela. And then you must not go to the Egyptian records and look for an Egyptian pharaoh who may have campaigned. You must look at the interventions in the Levant and the interrelations between Egypt and the Levant and see when did you have Egyptian campaigns in the Shephela. When do we have evidence for that? Because of course we have no evidence for that in the 21st dynasty. We have evidence for that, as we just spoke, in the Sait period, okay? We have evidence for that in the Nubian period, and we have evidence for that at the beginning of the 22nd dynasty with the campaign of Sheshonq. And these would be the better options to see whether any of these events really encompassed the Shephela and whether any of these events could have reached this succession story of Solomon and his heirs. And with this, I leave you because we're going to talk about Sheshonq in the next week. So thank you.